We'll now open with a reading from 1 Timothy chapter 2, and Potty will read that for us now. Thanks for that, Potty. So we'll leave it to Uncle Barry McClure to lead us to the title of Living in God's House.
Introduction and good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for inviting me to be with you tonight. I was almost able to give you a very early night because as I arrived, one of the hosts cornered me and said, "Don't you know there are no day visitors?" So I could have given you a very early night, but I apologise that that's not going to be the case. What we want to do tonight, young people, is to cover the latter part of 1 Timothy chapter 2. Sometimes it's seen as somewhat of a controversial section, which is a bit of a shame because what that can do is it can take away from the positive side of what we hope to do tonight. So what we want to do tonight is to make it positive and practical in terms of the lessons that we can all take from this section of Paul's letter to Timothy. Now, what I want to do is just to start off with a question. And the question is this. Oops, sorry. Who's your favourite Bible character and what's the main reason why? So, any thoughts? Sorry?
Apollos.
Why do you like Apollos?
Because he was such an amazing character. He was humble and willing to accept that what he had was the Holy Spirit and that he needed to learn. And also that he was such an amazing
character. Excellent. Fantastic. Okay, Apollos, thank you very much. Okay. Now, I want everyone to listen very carefully for the answers. Now, I'm not trying to just waste time here. It's supper. Oh, we're almost there. Keep going. No. I want you to listen. Sorry, that was... I want you to listen very carefully to what's said. Because, believe it or not, there is a purpose in this question. Anyone else? Thank you so much. That was excellent. Anyone else?
Moses.
Moses, why?
He did lots of things.
Excellent. Thank you. Anyone else? Anyone want to build on that maybe? A few more ideas about Moses. Anyone else?
Ruth.
Yes, what about Ruth? Why? What was the main reason? She's selfless. Okay. Now, I hope everyone's listening to the answers. By the way, this isn't orchestrated. I haven't gone around and say, "Hey, you, I want you to say Moses because he did lots of things." I promise you I'm not doing that either. Anyone else? Anyone else? Favourite character? Joseph, why?
He just legged it.
He legged it. I didn't orchestrate that one, I promise you. He legged it. All right. Thank you. Anyone else? Maybe one more.
Samson,
why?
Because he had a weakness.
He had a weakness. And what did he do with that weakness? He kept failing. But what did he do in terms of failing? Did he just turn around and say, "Hey, my life's a failure"? Yep. Exactly. So that weakness was actually able to be turned into something. So excellent. So thank you so much for those answers. And as I said, I hope everyone's been listening to what has been said. Okay, let's just have a talk now about 1 Timothy, and some of this you would have covered, no doubt, in your groups. But just some important background in terms of some of the things we're going to talk about tonight. We know from 1 Timothy 1 that Timothy was at Ephesus. So he was the pastor or the shepherd at the ecclesia in Ephesus. We know that the Apostle Paul wrote another letter to that ecclesia. So he wrote the letter to Timothy, who was at Ephesus. He also wrote a separate letter to that ecclesia. And one of the things he said to that ecclesia at Ephesus is this: submitting to one another. Now, can anyone see a problem with that? What happens if you live out what that says? Okay, so let's pick the sports afternoon. You're going to have a sports afternoon. So what are we going to play? And someone says, "Let's play soccer." But what do you want to play? Oh, let's play basketball. Oh, okay. We'll play basketball. Oh, no, but you want to play soccer. Oh, yeah, but you want to play basketball. But you wanted to play soccer. And it'd just go round and round and round, wouldn't it? If you live that out to the letter, it's unworkable. And yet what Paul is saying here in this particular part of Ephesians is, I want this spirit to be there amongst the ecclesia. So it doesn't matter if you're an old person in the meeting, a young person, I want this spirit to be there of submission. And really what we need to do is to finish this verse off to give the full picture, because he says this, submitting to one another in the fear of God. Now, what does that latter part of that verse mean? And how does it then give some meaning to this expression, I want you to submit to one another? How do you do it in the fear of God? Oh. No, I haven't even got it on. So count your blessings. I didn't want to put it on because... So, coming back to what we've got here, how does that latter part of that verse fill in the details, fill in the gaps? How do you submit to one another in the fear of God? What does that mean? In the reverence of God. Well, let's ask another question. How do we know whether we really do reverence God? We do what he says. So what he says is what then governs how we submit to each other. So if he says, look, I want this done in the ecclesia, and we say, well, that's what God says, I'll submit to that. If he says, I want that done, then we would submit to that. And in doing so, what we're doing is we're submitting, but we're doing it according to what God has to say, because we respect what God has to say. So just bear that in mind in terms of a bit of background of some of the things that we'll look at tonight. Our next key verse is taken from 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15. And this is taken from the New International Version. And Paul says this. Although I hope to come to you soon, Timothy, I'm writing you these instructions so that if I'm delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the ecclesia of the living God. So what this is all about, the primary reason for Paul writing this letter, as we've got here, it provides particular advice about living in God's house, conduct in the ecclesia. And yet, as you go through your study groups, no doubt what you'll find is that even though that's the focus of what Paul's saying, it's about behaviour in God's house, in God's ecclesia, how we live at home, how we live at work, what we do at school, is going to intersect with behaviour in God's house. It's not as if we can say, well, that's God's house over there, I'll behave in a certain way, and then when we go back home, or we go to school, we go to work, we go to uni, I can behave in a different way. Well, as we can see from Timothy, that's not the case. So the focus very much is on conduct in the ecclesia. Now, notice what we've got there at the bottom of the screen. What is the ecclesia? The ecclesia is the house of God. Now, how often we think of our ecclesias like that? It's a place where God wants to live. It's his house. But you notice how I've got there at the bottom of the screen? It's not our house, it's God's house, even though in Timothy's time it was. Now, what do you think I mean by that? Excellent. You see, in Paul's day, in Timothy's day, your house could be the ecclesia. So you think of it. For 6 days, that's your house. And you might have all of these rules about how I'm going to live in my house. And no children allowed. Don't put your feet up there. No, 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 you're not going to eat that over there. For 6 days, you set the rules because it's your house. And on one day of the week, that house is no longer your house, because God says the ecclesia meets in that house, and for that one day, it's my house. And therefore, all of the rules that you might have about how you live in your house and what happens in your house, well, on that one day, it all changes because God says, for that day, it's my house. And the way I want things done in my house will overrule what you might have in place in terms of your own house. Now, that'd be pretty challenging, wouldn't it? That's really challenging that for one day, that house is no longer yours. God says, it's my house. So the key for us young people is to think of our ecclesias like that. It's not our house. We don't run the ecclesia as we might want. It's really God saying, hey, it's my house. And I want you to run this house like I would ask you to do. So just bear that in mind in terms of the context of what we're looking at tonight. Now, key theme of this particular letter is godliness. And so therefore, when you think about it, godliness is a very fitting theme because, well, 1 Timothy provides particular advice about conduct in God's house, which is the ecclesia. So therefore, godliness in God's house, it makes sense. And that's why godliness is such a key theme of this particular letter. Okay, so the earlier parts of 1 Timothy chapter 2, the first two verses, is all about prayer. It's, in particular, it's highlighting the need for prayer and things to pray for. So Paul says, I urge you, first of all, requests, prayers, intercession, thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings, all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. So it's all about prayer. Now, I don't know if you noticed this about those first two verses. They're very circular, aren't they? Because God's saying, I want you to pray to me for the kings and the authorities where you live so that you can live peacefully. What's circular about that? What would be perhaps an easier way to go about it? Some examples. What would be a more direct way of going about bringing about a peaceful life for you?
Return of Christ.
Yeah, return of Christ, absolutely. Yep.
Revolution.
Revolution, do it yourself. You get out there. Okay, you protest. You bring about peace. Much better for you to do it. And God says, no, I don't want you to do it that way. I want you to actually pray to me so that I can do it on your behalf. You see, what's happening is it's really putting God way, way up there, isn't it? It's saying, God, I trust you so much. I elevate you so much that instead of taking things into my own hands, which would be, from a human point of view, much more direct, I'm actually going to put them in your hands so that you can bring about what you say. So straight away, we can see what the first part of 1 Timothy 2 is doing is it's putting God right up there. It's really elevating him. And so the focus here is very much on God. It's very much on his authority. Yes, you are in control. And it's very much about trusting him and his ability to help. So straight away, that's the context of 1 Timothy chapter 2. And again, what it's doing, young people, is it's highlighting the fact that God is above all. So then when you get to the latter part of 1 Timothy chapter 2, we get to verse 8, Paul once again comes back to this topic of prayer. And in particular, in verse 8, what he goes on to talk about is who is to pray in the house of God and how. So what does he say? This is taken from the New American Standard Bible. Therefore, I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and dissension. So what's this about? This is about behaviour in God's house. What does God want to happen in his house? I want men in every place to pray. Now, what you have in verse 8 is specifically referring to males. When you go through 1 Timothy chapter 2, for example, if you have a look at verse 1, you notice it talks there at the end of verse 1, thanks be made for all men. And the expression men there talks about mankind. It's not just males. When you get, for example, to verse 4, Thankfully, verse 4 is not just talking about males, because it says that God will have all men to be saved. He's not talking about males, he's talking about people. When you get to verse 9, he's specifically talking about women. So when you get to verse 8, it's particularly talking about males. What does he say? I want men to pray in every place. What does that mean? Well, in the context of what we're looking at, it's talking about in every ecclesia, bearing in mind that's the context in which Paul is writing this letter. It's conduct in God's house. So, what conclusion could we draw? Well, from verse 8, the context is suggesting that Paul's instruction is referring to prayer in the ecclesia. Notice it talks about praying, lifting up holy hands. Now, when you think about it, hands of themselves aren't holy. Like, nothing about your hands that are holy. So therefore, it can't be speaking just simply of literal hands. It's not just talking about a physical posture. Rather, it's using this concept of lifting up holy hands as a symbol in relation to prayer. What's the lifting up of holy hands a symbol of? Well, you notice the following verses taken from the Old Testament. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. It's though I'm elevating you, God. I'm lifting up my hands in your name. Psalm 63. Lamentations 3 verse 41. Let us lift up our hearts and hands to God in heaven. So you can see clearly it's not talking about something physical. You can't physically take your heart out and lift it up. That's not going to help. So it's using our hearts and our hands as a symbol of lifting them up in terms of our feeling, what we think about God, how great we see him in terms of the fact he's in heaven, we're down on earth. Psalm 28, hear the voice of my supplications when I cry to you, when I lift up my hands towards your holy sanctuary, when I lift up my hands to heaven. Where does God live? Well, he's in heaven. But what's Timothy all about? It's all about the fact that God's house isn't just in heaven. God's house is in the ecclesia. So we lift up our hands towards where God lives, but in the ecclesia, well, God says, that's my house. That's where I want to live. And so we can see, in terms of summary, of what this symbol is about. The lifting up of holy hands is a symbol of prayer, which is directed towards God in heaven. It's all about God things, not earthly things such as personal anger and disputes, as the verse goes on to talk about. It's all about behaviour that mirrors something that's holy, that elevates God. That's what this symbol is about. Well, how might it be possible, as verse 8 talks about, how might it be possible to bring anger or disputes into our prayers for the ecclesia? How can that be done? Well, young people, and particularly I would say to the brothers who perform this role in the ecclesia, if we bring our personal issues or feuds with others into our prayers, and when we're making that prayer on behalf of the ecclesia, then that's a source of anger and disputes. Let me give you an example. I was at an ecclesia once which was clearly going through turmoil, and a brother was praying, and in his prayer he said words to the effect, we ask a blessing on those who are causing division in our ecclesia. Can you think of that? He might have felt it genuinely, but we ask a blessing on those who are causing division in our ecclesia. And you can imagine the reaction in those who are praying. You know, is it me? What's the... And so the whole prayer lost everything else about it because people were just focusing on that statement. Who's he talking about? Well, is it me? Well, so that's just one example where we can bring personal issues that we might be having with someone else into our prayers that we offer on behalf of the ecclesia. Using language in our ecclesial prayers that's likely to cause contention or uncertainty. Again, perhaps another example. This was a combined activity. And I would say probably the average age of the people there, it was a fairly old group, it was probably in the early 60s. And the brother who offered the prayer said words to this effect: "Lord, bless us as we push the envelope to the edge of the table." Now, clearly he meant something. But you imagine, young people, and this is what happened, that prayer later, people, and particularly, as I said, the average age was probably late 50s, early 60s, and people go, "What letter? And what's the..." And it just caused confusion, and it caused disputes, because people then just talked about it. And as I said, it might have been done very genuinely, but the effect was very different. Just as an aside, we had a situation. My mother and father used to sort of run the young people's class in Sydney. And many, many years ago, my father, it was at Punchbowl Hall, and just by way of background, the hall was having a problem with crickets. Little crickets, and they were everywhere. And my dad asked a brother, and he was only newly baptised, if he'd like to pray. And the poor brother, because he didn't want to say no, but he was absolutely nervous because he'd never prayed before. So he got up to pray, and he was going through his prayer, and you could tell he was struggling, and he was thanking God for all these things, and he couldn't think of anything else to thank God for, and he said, "Thank you for the crickets." And you say, "Well, that's fine." Do you know what happened? The next day, my father got a phone call, and it was actually a phone call from another state. And someone rang my dad and said, "What's this I hear? That at your class, a brother was praying for the cricketers." That's true. I'm true. Okay? In a sense, young people, that's how you can turn a prayer into contention. Maybe not. Let's move on. Sorry, that's not a good example. How can we use our prayers as a means of causing disputes? Using concepts in our ecclesial prayers that is likely to cause controversy. Now, let me give you an example of this. And this one might be a little sensitive. Again, this was a combined activity, and a brother who was there who did not sort of belong to the ecclesia that was organising this activity was asked to pray. And in his prayer, he began to pray to Jesus. Now, I'm not getting into the debate on that, but that did cause controversy. And you think, look, it would be very unwise to go to an ecclesia where you don't know the people, you don't know what their feelings are on that topic, and to do that in an ecclesial prayer, because what the reaction was dispute. And so you can see there are ways in which we can bring these elements into the prayers that we offer on behalf of the ecclesia. What are some implications we can take from what we have in verse 8? Firstly, particularly for our brothers, leading prayer in the ecclesia is an important responsibility. Why? Because we're praying to God in his house on behalf of his family. That's what we're doing in an ecclesial prayer. Earthly things such as our personal whims, anger, disputes, bitterness, using prayers to incite controversy, they should never be a feature of ecclesial prayers. That's basically the advice that Paul is giving here. In ecclesial prayers, the focus needs to be on God. It needs to be on his household, the ecclesia. It needs to be on those who are mentioned, for example, in verses 1 and 2. The focus, young people, shouldn't be on me, what I feel, what I'm going to say. You see, for a brother who prays in the ecclesia of God, you're doing it on behalf of the family of God to the person who owns that house and wants to live in that house. And so a brother who's angry, who's contentious, he's going to be very unlikely to fulfill what we see in verse 1 and 2, a spirit of thankfulness, a spirit of elevating God, a spirit of saying, look, God's in control, he'll fix the problem. And certainly the spirit of verse 4, where God says, I want everyone to be saved, Well, you see, an angry and a contentious prayer is perhaps not going to be focusing too much on that. The question that comes up from time to time is, well, is verse 8 perhaps indicating the posture that we should take when a brother prays in the ecclesia? Because it does say, holding up holy hands. Well, what I'd suggest is, well, as we've seen, holding up holy hands is symbolic. It's like holding up your heart. It's not something you literally do. It's not a mandatory posture of how to pray. It's more the symbolism of what it's getting at. And when you have a look at the Bible, there's no set posture for prayer in the Bible. For example, some people stood, some kneeled, some fell on their faces to the ground, some held up their hands, some struck their breast, some bowed their head. In the case of Jesus, he just simply lifted up his eyes to heaven. And believe it or not, Nehemiah prayed while serving wine. So as you can see, young people, there is no set posture for praying. Rather, prayer in the ecclesia, the house of God, is essentially about our attitude. It's not so much about posture. And this is the key. Always remember who we're praying to. We're praying to God. Whose house we're in when we're praying? It's God's house. And whose household or family we're praying on behalf of? It's God's family. So when we put all of those elements together, perhaps it will help us in terms of our ecclesial prayers. So we go then to the next two verses where Paul specifically talks concerning women. In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety, and basically what that means is discretion or self-restraint, and moderation, not with broidered hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now, first of all, you notice something about this verse, verse 9. He's speaking specifically here, or particularly concerning women in the house of God, but you notice how he commences. In like manner also. So what does that mean? In like manner also. What does that mean? Yeah, it's the same mindset, isn't it? It's the same spirit that you have in verse 8. Now, in verse 8, he's talking about men praying. Here, he's talking about something very different. So even though it's different, he's saying, look, it's the same mindset, the same spirit that is behind both. It's the spirit of submitting. So just as men who pray in the ecclesia were to prepare and behave in an appropriate manner, so the spirit is, women are to prepare and behave in an appropriate manner too. And even though their roles might be different, the same spirit underpins these roles. And yet it goes further than these young people, because it's not just simply limited to the same spirit, but elements of behaviour too. You notice in verse 9, it talks about women. Those same expressions appear in the very next chapter in talking about men. Talking about a totally different sphere, but he's saying for a woman performing that, well, that's the behaviour. And for a man doing this, it's the same behaviour. It's the same spirit that is right across. Why? Because it's God's ecclesia. It's God's house. And that's what he is looking for. And so what Paul is doing for us here in verses 9 to 10 is encouraging modesty and discretion. So instead of focusing excessively on outward adorning, he's saying, look, focus rather on being clothed with good works. Some implications of this. Well, just as anger and disputing in ecclesial prayers can lead to ecclesial contention and strife, so too can overly focusing on outward adorning. Because excessive concentration, or alternatively, and this equally applies, a lack of attention to what we wear and how we appear in the ecclesia, what it can do is it serves to draw attention to the individual rather than to God. So when we sort of deliberately dress down, the focus is on us. When we deliberately dress up, the focus isn't so much on God and the fact it's God's house. The focus is on, hey, look at me. And again, young people, the key for us is always bear in mind It's not our house. It's God's house. And so, as a result, instead of the focus being on godliness and good works, the focus can instead be on, hey, look at me. Verse 11 goes on to say this. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Now again, it's important to bear in mind the setting for this. As we've seen from 1 Timothy 3 verse 15, Paul's providing instruction in this particular letter on how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the ecclesia. So always just bear that setting in mind. What do we take from verses 11 and 12? Well, while the New Testament does speak of women performing a teaching role in certain circumstances, what it seems to be saying is that when it comes to the ecclesia, Paul instructs that men are to take responsibility for leading and for verbally teaching the ecclesia. The key, again, is this is God's house. This is how God is asking for things to be done. It's not our house. So in the spirit of submission, we will listen to what God has to say. Let a woman learn in silence. So you notice from verse 11 that women are to learn in the ecclesia just as men are. What does it mean to be in silence? Well, it's interesting that that word is translated in verse 2 as peaceable, that we might live peaceable lives. When you look up a concordance such as Strong's, it has the idea of a stillness or to keep one's seat. Okay, which is very much the sense of what we have in verse 2. I want you to live a peaceable life. In Acts chapter 22, the same word is used there to describe a quiet and attentive audience that's listening to a presenter. So that seems to be the spirit of what Paul is saying here in terms of behaviour in the ecclesia of God. Some implications of what we see here. In God's house, men and women are to perform some different, albeit similarly important roles. Ecclesial leadership and instruction of God's house are to be performed by brothers, from what Paul is saying. Sisters, on the other hand, will perform a vital supporting, caring and nurturing role in God's house, the sphere of their greatest strength, we will find, God willing, in verse 15. Now, the key, young people, is that both roles are critical. Far too much emphasis is placed on speakers and the speaking role, as we will talk about shortly. The role that is played in terms of caring and nurture is absolutely critical. And so, therefore, both roles complement each other and both are essential in the kingdom, in the house of God. Ecclesial leadership and teaching roles are important responsibilities. So if, as a brother, you have that responsibility, perform it diligently. Why? It's not your house. It's God's house. It's not your people. It's not your friends you're talking to. It's God's family. That's who we're speaking to. So therefore, treat them with that respect and courtesy. Be diligent in terms of serving in God's house. As we've got there, always remember whose house we're in. It's God's house. Whose family we're leading and serving. It's God's family. And also just bear in mind who the head of the house is, who the head of the household is. It's Christ, because he is the head of the ecclesia. Okay, so let's just do a little test now. Let's have a bit of a break. Which of the following six scenarios fit the responsibilities we've seen so far? Scenario number one, I've got a talk to prepare for Bible class tomorrow night, but I can just wing it. What do you reckon? Who are you not showing respect to? God's family. Okay, so it's God's household. It's like you are a brother or sister of God, in a sense. That's what we've got to get. That's the mindset that Paul's saying, hey, that's how we need to treat each other. That's the respect we need to show It's not just anyone. This is part of God's family. Okay, so we are showing absolutely no respect to that. And I guess really we're showing no respect to God to say, well, I know it's your house, but hey, I'll just wing it. I've got a real thing about Bible translations. I'm going to do my next exhort on that. What's wrong with that? You're just focusing on you and what I feel like. And it might be a big deal for me, but hey, you've got God's house there and they're screaming out for support. They're doing it tough. And so instead of saying, hey, what does God's family really need? What would really help? The focus instead in terms of this approach is, well, this is about me and about what my whim is. And it's very much different to the spirit that we see in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Bible reading is just for boys, and I'm not a boy. What's wrong with that? What have we just seen in terms of what Paul says? Okay, so women learn too. It's not just simply a male thing. It's men and women. Both have a responsibility and a desire to do that. Paul says that women should be in silence, so keep quiet, put on your hat, and get into the kitchen. What is wrong with that? What is wrong with that? And I, ashamedly, I have heard, even though it's been said in jest, I've heard comments like that made. What is wrong with that? What is wrong with that mindset?
Everything,
absolutely. Okay, so let's go through the everythings. Let's start. What's number one wrong with that?
Demeaning.
It's demeaning, okay? So this is a member of God's house who is just totally demeaned. Yep, what else? Yes, that's all right. So you get 10 out of 10 for being silly. Excellent. Absolutely. God wants his daughters to know about him. Now let's just talk about the head covering or the hat. What is the symbol of the head covering? What is it teaching? What's the two key lessons from 1 Corinthians 11 that the head covering is teaching God's household? Whose head?
Christ.
You see, when a woman wears a hat, a covering on her head, and her head represents man, she's wiping man out of the picture. She's saying, hey, you're not the head of this ecclesia. Christ is. So when a man, if it was a man who said that, he misunderstands totally what that symbol is. That in fact the head covering should be saying to him, you be quiet, you get out and serve, because the head of this ecclesia isn't you, it's Christ. And the other element of the covering of the head is it's to highlight the fact that it's all about not the glory of man, it's all about the glory of God. Why? Hey, it's his house. This is where he wants to live. So therefore we elevate him, and therefore the wearing of a head covering is teaching that. Okay, so you see these things that sometimes might be said in jest, and you say it is totally inappropriate in terms of the spirit of what we're seeing in 1 Timothy chapter 2. The ecclesial platform is the most important place in the ecclesia. True or false? Absolutely false. Okay, young people, and unfortunately that sometimes is the mindset that says this role is all important. It is absolutely not. And we'll come back and revisit that. And just bear in mind in terms of what we're saying here, just remember the answers that were given to our very first question tonight. And our final one, scenario number 6, they're doing it tough, so what? Life's tough. The pansies. Well, that's not in there. What's wrong with that, young people, if we take that approach in terms of God's family?
Not helping.
Okay? It's as if we're not part of this family. We don't belong to this family. They're there. They can just do it tough. And yet, really what Timothy is being told here by Paul is as the ecclesia of God, God wants to live and dwell here, and we need to treat each other as being part of the same family. Now, Paul, in the next two verses, gives reasons for what he says in verses 11 to 12. Now, you notice the first reason. Adam was formed first, then Eve. So this is reason number one, why he gives the instruction in verses 11 and 12 in terms of the role of women in the ecclesia and the role of men. So reason number one, Adam was formed first, then Eve. So the first reason is the order of man and woman in creation. Now notice that. Sometimes a concept is that verses 11 and 12 is only talking about married men and married women. And it doesn't apply to men and women generally in the ecclesia. But you see, the very first reason Paul gives for his instruction has got absolutely nothing to do with marriage. In fact, Adam was formed first, then Eve. So for a time, Adam existed, Eve didn't. They weren't married at that stage. So it's got nothing to do with marriage and married couples. In fact, Paul uses the same ideas from Genesis in 1 Corinthians 11, where he talks about the fact that Christ is the head of man and man is the head of the woman. And he uses that in terms of what he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. So what that's saying is that man in the ecclesia is to represent Christ. The woman in the ecclesia represents man. That's in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. So if you have women in the ecclesia teaching men, using the symbology there, it's like you'd have man teaching Christ. And that wouldn't be appropriate because Christ is the head of the ecclesia. So even in the symbology there, you see the same pattern in terms of what Paul is saying here in 1 Timothy chapter 2. So reason number one, it's the order of creation. Reason number two, Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into the transgression. So the second reason he gives for his instruction is based on the circumstances in which sin entered into the world. So what do these reasons indicate? Firstly, young people, they indicate that Paul's instruction in verses 11 and 12 is based on events that happened in the beginning, one of which occurred before sin entered into the world and even before Adam and Eve were married. So it's going right back to the beginning. The second reason indicates this, that Paul's instruction is timeless. It's not just simply based on the customs or the circumstances of his own day. Referring back to Adam and Eve, and even further back to that, to the creation of Adam, the custom back then was totally different to the custom of Paul's day. So therefore, he's not just referring to the custom of his day in terms of this instruction about behaviour in the house of God. Rather, the instruction is founded on abiding Bible-based principles that were established in the very beginning. Now, it's interesting. Verse 14, Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. You know, this verse provides us with insights into circumstances that Genesis doesn't even talk about. So here's where the New Testament actually gives us some more detail about what happened in the beginning that we're not aware of in Genesis. Eve was deceived. The Emphasized Bible puts it, she was wholly deceived. She was totally beguiled by the serpent, which caused her to disobey God's instruction, and she then invited Adam to do likewise. And in doing so, she exercised authority over Adam. And yet, while Eve entered into sin beguiled, Adam did not. Which tells us this. He listened to Eve. He followed her lead into sin, even though he knew that she and what she was saying was totally wrong. So you think of that, young people. Like, Eve was deceived. Adam knew exactly what he was doing. And that's why when you come across passages like Romans 5, where it says, by one man sin entered the world, and people at our seminar say, hey, that's not right because Eve was the first to sin. Well, yes, that's true, but Adam was the one who knew exactly what he was doing. And he made a deliberate choice to say, hey, do I listen to Eve? I know what she's saying is wrong. I know what God has said. Do I make that choice? Or do I follow her lead and I sin? And as Paul is highlighting here in verse 14, unfortunately, Adam, well, he followed what he wanted to do, and as a result, in following Eve's lead. Instead of telling her, look, sorry, you're wrong, he did what she said, and so therefore sin came into the world. So, verse 15 concludes with this. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. Now, you notice that this passage commences with a contrast. It's a contrast to what's stated in verses 11 and 14. So the word nevertheless, it's a contrast word. Why do you think that's the case? Why do you think verse 15 starts off with a contrast? What might it be possible to do if you look at those earlier verses? What might be a possible conclusion you could form in looking at verses 11, 12, 13 and 14? Yeah, woman is damned, woman is inferior. That's a conclusion you could perhaps form. And so Paul hits that on the head and says, nevertheless, no, notwithstanding. That's not the case. This is not about superiority or inferiority. It's got nothing to do with that. So he says, nevertheless, she will be saved. And as we've got there, it might be possible to wrongly conclude from the previous verses that women in the household of God are somehow inferior to men. This is clearly not the case. So that's not what Paul is saying. So, what does he mean then, verse 15? Well, I'll suggest that there's five possible options. So when he says, nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. Well, let's go through the options as to what Paul might mean by this. Option number one. Faithful women will be saved, that is, they will be preserved or safeguarded when giving birth. So that's one possible option as to what Paul might mean in verse 15. Women will be preserved when they give give birth. However, the problem is that faithful women have died when giving birth. So clearly that option can't be true. And not only that, within the context of 1 Timothy 2, the salvation being referred to in verse 15 seems to be eternal salvation, as you have it back in verse 4. So he's not talking about being preserved. It seems to be talking about salvation, as in eternal salvation. Option number two. What does Paul mean? Eve will be saved through childbearing because this would be the means by which Jesus the Saviour, who was Eve's promised descendant, would later come. So in other words, the option is, well, Paul's specifically talking about Eve. However, the verse seems to be referring to women and not just to Eve. You notice when you read it, nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue. So the she seems to be referring not to Eve, but to women in general, and that's borne out by other translations. The New American Standard Bible, but women shall be saved through bearing of children. The New International Version, but women will be saved. So it's not talking about Eve, it seems to be talking about women. Option number three, what does verse 15 mean? Faithful women will be saved because they have children. In other words, having children is crucial to eternal salvation. The problem with that option is that it implies inferiority to women who do not or cannot have children and their salvation. And there's absolutely no evidence in the Bible of that. In fact, the example of Jephthah's daughter would counter that. So she never had children, but she seems to be a very faithful person. So that option doesn't seem to fit. Option number four. Faithful women shall be saved by means of the childbearing. Because there is a definite article there. It is the childbearing. So the option is, well, that's talking about a specific birth. That's talking about the birth of Jesus Christ. Therefore, faithful women will be saved by Jesus Christ. The problem with that is it's not just women who are saved by Jesus Christ. Men are saved by Jesus Christ as well. And not only that, at the time Paul was writing to Timothy, Jesus Christ had already been born. So instead of saying she shall be saved by childbearing, Paul more accurately should have said, she has been saved by childbearing because Christ had already been born. And not only that, if that's what Paul meant, then why does he make it so obscure? Why not just simply say, look, if he's talking about Jesus Christ, women shall be saved by Jesus Christ? So I'd suggest that that option also doesn't quite fit. So what option is there? Well, we come to option 5, and this is what I would suggest that verse means. That faithful women have particular strengths in the crucial area of childbearing. And by childbearing, it's not just simply having children, but it has the idea of parenting and motherhood. This is how the 20th century New Testament puts it. But women will find their salvation in motherhood. And the concept is actually picked up in chapter 5, verse 14, where childbearing appears in conjunction with women managing a natural household or family. So in summary, what verse 15 seems to be saying is this, that faithful women will be saved just like men, but the main sphere of their good works and salvation takes on a different focus to that of men in the house of God. Although they may not perform a communal leadership and verbal teaching role in the house of God in relation to brothers, sisters must never be considered to have any lesser or inferior role to play than brothers. Because in the household of God, faithful women perform these absolutely vital roles. And in particular, it's in the ambit of the natural household that faithful women particularly excel. Now, the key is for us young people living today as we do, never let's devalue that. Never let's denigrate this particular role, because the Western world is paying a terrible price for ignoring God's advice. It's interesting, just on Saturday in the Sydney newspaper, there was an article that talked about a sensation that was caused last year in Great Britain when a family court judge came out and said this, and it absolutely caused a stir. He said, and he dared to say, that was the context in which it was put, he dared to say that family breakdown was the cause of most social ills in Great Britain. And he talked about the fact that he would see a never-ending carnival of human misery. He would see the damage that was done by children, and one of the elements was pedophilia. One of the reasons pedophilia is becoming so big was, yes, there is more reporting, but where you have a breakdown in families, and this is the expression that's used, you have musical relationships, you have passed the partner, as he put it, then the situation for pedophilia is absolutely rife. And when you think about what Paul's advice here is, well, people don't want to listen to God's advice. They've got other ideas. And so what's happening now is that sort of situation is reaching epidemic proportions. And so therefore, the Western world is paying very dearly in terms of not heeding God's advice. So the key from verse 15 is this. Without strong natural households or families, the spiritual household or family of God will not flourish. Now you'll see that as you go through your studies. When you come to chapter 3, what happens at home is absolutely critical for what happens in the ecclesia. If you've got a home that's falling apart, that's going to impact the ecclesia. And so therefore, that's why the role, particularly where women excel, is so vital, not just in terms of the natural family, but for God's family as well. However, the key also is that 1 Timothy 2 verse 15 is not meant to be an absolute for all faithful women. It's referring to the general sphere in which a sister's role and unique strengths will excel. So just as not all brothers will be leaders or instructors of the ecclesia, just as not all brothers will lead the ecclesia in prayer, so too not all sisters may be directly involved in childbearing or parenting. And so therefore that's why verse 15 ends as it does, that despite the different roles and the different spheres where each will work, and despite the different roles that sisters and brothers might play in the ecclesia, persevering in faith, love and holiness with self-control, as verse 15 says, is absolutely critical, irrespective of whether you're a male or a female in God's house. Okay, so let's just finish with some final exhortation Okay, who's your favourite Bible character and what's the main reason why? Did anyone notice a thread in all of the answers? Yeah, which was demonstrated in what? In their behaviour. Okay? Notice that no one said, oh, I really like that person because they gave really good talks. In fact, the person who talked about Apollos could have done that because Apollos was a great speaker. He was a great orator. But it wasn't his talks that stood out. It was his character. It was his behaviour. What's that telling us? Absolutely. The greatest teacher of all isn't what we say. So by me up here talking to you, they're just words. It's behaviour that really is the teacher. And you think of that. People who stand out in your life, it's not so much from the great talks they give. It's the way they live. That's what makes them stand out. And when you think of all of those examples that you gave, it was their behaviour. Despite their weaknesses, that's what stands out about the individual. So never think that, oh, we should be up here speaking and that's really the key, that's the be-all and end-all. It's not true, young people. It's behaviour and character that are the greatest teachers of all. Now let's look at just one final example to show that. What's the most powerful teaching tool? Well, I would suggest, young people, it's our behaviour. It's our personal example. Notice the example of Jesus that Paul uses in 1 Timothy chapter 6, as we will look at. And I thank Brother T.J. Redding for this idea. Where he says in chapter 6, verse 13, I urge you before Christ Jesus, who witnessed the good confession before Pontius Pilate. So this is what Paul says, and he refers to Jesus who witnessed a good confession before Pontius Pilate. The question is, what was the good confession that Jesus witnessed before Pontius Pilate? Anyone like to say? Exactly right. Matthew 27, Mark 15. This is taken from Matthew 27. This is the good confession of Jesus before Pontius Pilate. And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, Jesus answered nothing. Then Pilate said to him, do you not hear how many things they testify against you? And Jesus answered him, not one word. So the governor marveled greatly. You see, young people, in this case, Jesus was silent. You don't have to be speakers. You don't have to talk in order to be someone who can teach. In this case, it was Jesus' character and the fact he said nothing that so impressed Pilate. And that's why Paul says that was the ultimate confession. That a man who could be falsely accused, who could have got up and given the greatest speech ever, he just sat there, he submitted himself in the fear of God, and he said not one word. It's our behaviour, it's our character that's demonstrated in our actions that is the greatest teacher. So let's just finish where we began, 1 Timothy 3, verse 15. Although I hope to come to you soon, I'm writing you these instructions that I am so that if I'm delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the ecclesia. And do you notice this? It's the ecclesia of the living God. How is the ecclesia the house of the living God? Exactly. And they're living members, and what will they be doing to demonstrate that God is alive? They'll be doing what God wants. They'll be following God's instruction. They'll be saying, hey, yes, this is his house, and we're going to do what he says because it's his house. You see, that's how it becomes a living ecclesia. That's how we know God is alive, because we're actually living what he has to say. So young people, we'll leave it at that. I hope that sort of covered some issues. But as we can see, this topic should not be controversial, because there is so many positives that we can take from this in terms of the fact that we're all here today, tonight, those who are baptised, you're part of God's family. When you go to your ecclesias, you're in God's house, and it's a living house, it's a living God when we actually live the things that God asks us to perform in his house.